welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In October 1621, the Plymouth colonists and the Wampanoag Indians shared a harvest festival that we remember today as the first Thanksgiving celebration in the American colonies. But it wasn't until 1863, in the midst of the Civil War, that President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed a national holiday of Thanksgiving to be held each November. Today on All Sides, we'll explore the real history and the mythology surrounding Thanksgiving, the Pilgrims, Native Americans, and the founding of America. Joining us again is Ken Davis, the author of Don't Know Much About History, Anniversary Edition, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. He's also the author of America's Hidden History, Untold Tales of the First Pilgrims, Fighting Women, and Forgotten Founders Who Shaped a Nation. Ken has been dubbed the King of Knowing by Amazon.com. He says Americans don't hate history, they just don't like the dull version they slept through when they were in school. Welcome back to the show, Ken.
Hi, Ann. Glad to be with you, as always, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. To our listeners, you got a question about Thanksgiving, some of the myths? Do you have a bet with somebody you want to settle? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken, we all have heard the story of the first Thanksgiving as school children, somber pilgrims dressed in those somber black outfits with clunky shoes and buckled hats, and they sat down to a Thanksgiving feast with friendly Indians who came to their rescue and saved the starving settlers. True, false, can you clarify?
It ain't necessarily so, I think is the best way to put it. This is such a conglomeration of myths and images and legends from now more than almost four centuries. It's quite astonishing that we still celebrate it at all. And actually, the kids are learning a much better version today than certainly I did when I was a kid growing up. Let's get rid of the clunky shoes, first of all. That's the traditional garb of Puritans who came much later in New England history, and they were different from pilgrims, and we can sort out that difference in a minute. But that was the Sunday finery, the Sabbath best of the Puritans, and it was also a very idealized version of it that was painted and depicted in the 19th century. But the people we call the pilgrims, the people who came on the Mayflower, were essentially simple farming English farmers. They would have wore linen and cotton and wool, and it would have been dyed in a variety of colors, and they wouldn't have looked like that at all. They arrived, as we know, December 1620, a spectacularly bad time to start a colony in Massachusetts, if you know New England at all. Mm-hmm. And the men came ashore and started to build a rudimentary communal house while the women stayed on board. The Mayflower would not sail back for 3 months. They did not want to risk an ocean crossing in the wintertime. 102 passengers, only half of them make it through the first brutal winter into the fall. Exposure, malnutrition, disease, just a whole host of problems that they had to face. And so the survivors in October of 1621 are mostly grateful just to be alive.
My guest is Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History. We're talking about Thanksgiving, the tradition of Thanksgiving, the myths surrounding Thanksgiving. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So Abraham Lincoln, when he made it a national holiday, such as it was he thinking of the pilgrims, or, you know, where did this visual come up where everyone's sitting around a table with a big fat turkey and, what we think of as the pilgrims dressed in black?
Lots of things to sort out there. Let's start with Abraham Lincoln and the creation of the true holiday. The Thanksgiving as a holiday had been celebrated in several New England states going back as early as the 1670s. They were starting to recognize this idea of a celebration of this foundation legend, and the happy first meal in October, by the way, not November. Lincoln sets the date in 1863. What's the picture here? Well, it's the Civil War. Things are not going well in the Civil War. Lincoln had been asked, as every president had been asked for 30 years, to make Thanksgiving a national holiday. That was at the request of a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale. She was, to put it mildly, the Martha Stewart of her day. She edited a magazine called Lady Godey's Book. It was the Good Housekeeping of its day. She was very influential. She published other women writers. She published recipes. But she believed that this holiday should be celebrated and had asked every president to make it a holiday. Lincoln agrees, and it's a very specific reason. He saw this as a holiday that really celebrated the values of American nationhood. He wanted to say, this is a holiday that shows us that we all come from the same traditions, the same background, and we should honor and respect that. Unfortunately, it didn't really help solve any of the problems of the Civil War, but it did create a national holiday that we still enjoy. It's been a little bit of a movable feast. Lincoln said it on the last Thursday in November. Roosevelt moved it up one year to the third Thursday because the retailers wanted him to extend the shopping season during the Depression. Congress got mad and moved it back to the fourth Thursday in November, which is where it is. We can have five Thursdays in November. That's why it's set on the 4th, so it's not too late in the calendar.
This was a really big, hairy deal, too, back when Roosevelt did that.
Yes, it was. People saw this as, first of all, bowing to crass commercialism, and Congress was looking to pick fights with Roosevelt anyway, but it was the traditionalists who were saying, no, 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 we can't. So they actually had this year where people said there were two Thanksgivings that year, whether you did it on the third Thursday or the fourth Thursday. Needless to say, the connection to the holiday shopping season, that wasn't a creation of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Of course, the Macy's Parade had pretty well established that, and of course, that goes back to 1921. Tomorrow's will be the 80th anniversary. Oh. So this connection between the Macy's Day Parade ushering in the holiday season is an old one. The interesting aspect of that that ties into Thanksgiving as well is that Macy's did this in part because a lot of their workers were fairly recent European immigrants, and many of them were very familiar with a tradition of a harvest festival that included a parade through town. And that's a reminder that that's what the pilgrims were doing in 1621. They were not celebrating Thanksgiving. They were celebrating the harvest. And so this idea of a harvest festival and the Italian and European traditions of a parade at harvest time all come together in the Macy's Day Parade.
Mike in Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks. I was just wondering, earlier you were talking about the colonists that came and arrived in December. And where did you say they landed?
Well, that's an interesting question because they were supposed to land much further south. They were supposed to land in what was then the Virginia colony, maybe as far north as modern-day New York. Storms, they said, blew them further north, and so they land first at the tip of what is now Cape Cod, Provincetown. They explore that area for a while. They don't find enough fresh water, so they move on and then find this beautiful harbor, and they settle in Plymouth, what they call Plymouth. So it was questioned at the time whether this was, you know, truly an accident of storms or whether they had deliberately landed this far north because doing so, they were not under the control of the Virginia colony, which already existed. So there's still a little controversy about why they landed where they landed.
Oh, well, that was my question. I just didn't know if they didn't have the navigation or didn't understand that where they were going to land was going to be so gosh darn cold.
Bad planning.
Well, that's an interesting point because this was not unknown territory to them or to Englishmen. English sailors, other European sailors had been up and down these coasts for a very, very long time fishing this part of the world. They had stopped and traded with the Indians. That's one reason when the pilgrims arrived and they finally settled into the camp in March, a hungry, bedraggled Native American walks into their village or their settlement and speaks to them in English. He had learned it from other English sailors and fishermen. So part of the remarkable story of this Thanksgiving.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mike. You know, speaking of you, just preparing for this today reminded me of the Mayflower Compact, and you kind of get into it a little bit. Were they really just blown off course by a storm, or did they want to avoid being controlled by the powers that be in the Virginia colony?
Well, that's the question that's a little bit unsettled, mm-hmm. and so we don't know. But it's clearly the case that is what happened. The captain wrote that he had been blown there by storms and that he didn't want to proceed any further south because it was stormy. It was now late in December. That's the reason the Mayflower did not return to England. It stayed there for 3 months. The women and children stayed on board the Mayflower for the most part during those 3 months, and the men came ashore and started to build the rudimentary settlement, starting off with a communal house, as I mentioned. So that aspect of it is a little uncertain, but the more to the point of the Mayflower Compact, and this gets into a little bit more of who these people were, only half of the so-called pilgrims on the Mayflower were actually people we would call pilgrims. In other words, those people coming specifically for religious reasons. The other half were known as strangers, and they were coming for the basic idea of getting some land in this new world. To an Englishman at that time, the idea of acquiring property, especially to pass on to your children, was almost impossible. All the land was taken by by the nobility. So it was really, for half of the people, more about real estate than religion. And that's one of the reasons they felt it was important to have this Mayflower Compact, because they didn't know who was going to be in charge now. And the Mayflower Compact is a very, very fundamental idea saying we were going to govern ourselves. So it was the first written constitution, in a sense, in English American history.
What about the French Huguenots or Huguenots? They arrived in Florida in the 1660s. Whatever happened to them? And I guess the same could be asked for whatever happened to the Spanish when they landed in Florida.
St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question, and these are stories that got left out of most of our history books because we really got the New England-flavored version of history growing up. But there were true pilgrims, people coming for religious freedom in America 50 years before the Mayflower sailed. They were French Huguenots. Some people do say Huguenots. Mm-hmm. Those are French Protestants, and they were escaping the same kind of religious warfare and persecution that was going on in England. They were given permission to start a colony, which they did, called Fort Caroline. It's off the coast of what is now Jacksonville on the coast of Florida. The problem was that this was Spanish territory at that time, at least Spain thought so. So the Spanish king sends a fleet and an admiral over to get rid of these Frenchmen, not because they're French so much, but because they're Protestants. And this is the really important part of the story. The Spanish, who are Catholic, wipe out the French colony, and they say, we do this not to Frenchmen, but as to Protestants. This was a religious bloodbath. In other words, the first encounter between Europeans in what became America was really a massacre over religion. And what more important story is there? This really is an episode that got left out of our school books. Even if you go down to St. Augustine today, you don't see much about it. It's an uncomfortable, unhappy story, but that is the reason that St. Augustine was founded, as a sort of forward operating base to wipe out these Frenchmen. There is a river and a spot and actually a fort near St. Augustine called Matanzas, which is the Spanish word, comes from the Spanish word for slaughters. This is where hundreds of French sailors and soldiers and settlers were put to death by the Spanish 50 years before the Mayflower sailed.
My guest is Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History. We are talking about the stories surrounding, leading up to, taking away from Thanksgiving. So if you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can check out the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The The fallout from the super committee's super failure. 8 GOP presidential contenders meet to debate national security. Newt brushes off Freddie Mac to stay at the top of the polls while President Obama books a trip to New Hampshire. I'm Neil Cunnan. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to check in on New Hampshire and Iowa. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Gradually clearing skies this afternoon, a high of 50 degrees. Clear skies tonight as well, a low of 30. Expect some sunshine for Thanksgiving Day and a high of 56. Clear skies for Thursday night, a low of 38 degrees, and more sunshine on Friday with a high of 61. Currently 44 degrees with some clouds in downtown Columbus. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the history surrounding Thanksgiving and the Thanksgiving holiday. My guest is Ken Davis. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History. We've already talked about Don't Know Much About History, the anniversary edition, everything you need to know about American history but never learned. Questions or comments for Ken Davis, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Beth? In Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Off speakerphone.
All right.
She's basting the turkey.
Yes.
Well, my question was, where did this thing with, like, the Indians planting, showing Americans how to plant corn with dead fish, you know, carcasses, and it just seems to me, in my memory, it was all kind of blurred together. Like, they're having a party, they're planting corn, they're, you know.
There's dead fish around.
There's dead fish around, yeah.
And where did candy corn come from? No, but yeah, right.
It's another story, yeah.
Well, the real question is, where did those marshmallows on the sweet potatoes come from? That's the question we really have to get to the bottom of, because there's no reference to that in any of the Pilgrim accounts. But it's a good point. Let me spin the whole narrative out here a little bit more. We've got the pilgrims arriving, the pilgrims and the strangers arriving in December 1620. They make a compact. They're going to rule themselves. They really struggle. It's a bad time to start a colony. They obviously can't plant crops in December. But in March, a Native American walks into camp and speaks to them. And then he comes back a few days later with another Native American who we know as Squanto. And he indeed settles in with the English settlers and does begin to show them how to survive in this new world. And yes, he shows them how the Native Americans plant their crops, and they do put dead fish in with the planting. It's a natural fertilizer, and smart Native Americans. And he was teaching them to plant what the Native called the Three Sisters, maize or corn, squash, and beans. And those were holy throughout the Native American world of in North America. So this is what they are very, very settled there. The rest of the Indians who come along aren't great friends and happy sit-down buddies, but they do form a kind of uneasy alliance. The Wampanoag, that's the name of this nation, this tribe, recognize that the English could be very, very useful allies in some of their battles against other neighboring nations. So it wasn't like the English were good friends with everybody. They were good friends with this one particular tribe. And so when October rolls around and they are having their feast and they sit down to celebrate this first harvest coming in and the fact that they have survived, only half, by the way, make it through that first year, they are very surprised that 90 Indians show up. But the Indians were very good guests, and they went out and killed some deer, so there was fresh venison on the table as well.
Was religious proselytizing part of the goal at all when it came to their interactions with Indians at that point?
Not so much for the pilgrims at that point. That is much more significant later on as the great Puritan migration begins. And so let me give a quick difference here between Pilgrim and Puritan.
Mm-hmm.
Pilgrims were people who wanted to completely break away from the Church of England. They were radical separatists. They were a cult in our language. They were not welcome in England. They had been pushed out to Holland for a while, weren't happy there. Their children weren't growing up English. And they are presented with this opportunity to come to America and practice their religion as they saw fit. Puritans were people, on the other hand, who were loyal to the Church of England, but they still felt that it needed to be further reformed. Remember, the Church of England is created by Henry VIII mm-hmm. when he wants a divorce, can't get one, and so he makes his
own
church.
From the Catholic Church, yeah.
That's correct. And so this was the English Reformation, and there were many, many people in the English Church of England who did not think that the church had gone far enough, that it was too much, it was too what they would call popish, meaning too Catholic. And this was a really big battle. This wasn't just, you know, how to say your prayers. The people went to death over this. Heretics were burned on both sides
mm-hmm.
Over several hundred years. So this was a violent and bloody argument, as it was in the rest of Europe as the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation goes on. So the Pilgrims come first. They are followed by this great emigration of Puritans in the 1630s. Tens of thousands come, and they really transform the New England landscape. And it's some of the Puritan settlers who really decide that part of their mission is to bring these Indians to Christianity. And in fact, the first Bible printed in America, in the United States of America, was a Bible produced in Boston in the Algonquian language, because they felt that this was so important to convert these natives. There were actually Puritans who believed that this was the New Jerusalem, that this new land was where the second coming could actually happen. And they thought to do that, they had to convert the natives. So that was a big issue for, not for the first generation of Pilgrims, but for the later generation of Puritans.
Bobby on the East Side, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bobby. Hello, Bobby? Bobby? Bobby, you're listening to the radio. We cannot talk to you if you're listening to the radio. Okay. Ron in London, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I was listening to your program. I'd like to thank you guys because you're always putting out real good information about history. My question was, how did turkey become the main course at Thanksgiving time? Because as I understand it, they had a lot of other food that they were serving and everything. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Ron.
Thank you. That's, the real centerpiece question here, isn't it? What did they eat in October 1621? Well, a lot more seafood than we typically think of as Thanksgiving. After all, these people were on the banks, on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean at a time when you basically put a net in the water and you caught cod. So there was cod, there was haddock, there was clams, mussels, lobster, eel, not something we usually think of as a traditional Thanksgiving side dish, but eel would be very appropriate. I mentioned they grew corn, squash, and beans. That would have been there. They certainly ate cranberries. They called them craneberries, and not as a jam or a preserve, but they would have eaten them raw, mixed in with a salad of some kind. There was a lot of wild game. Duck, geese, and yes, wild turkey, not the turkey that we envision. The whole turkey dinner that we think of as the festive holiday dinner is really a creation of Victorian England and America, and because Thanksgiving really did become a Victorian era holiday in 1863 and afterwards, that's when that really moves front and center as the main course for Thanksgiving dinner.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Davis, the author of Don't Know Much About History. We're talking about the myths and the history revolving around Thanksgiving and early American history. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. www.thecolonist.org. We have an email from Alex. He writes, asks, describe the reaction of Puritans to lobsters in view of the Old Testament prohibition against eating fish without scales.
You know what? I've never been asked this question before, and I may say that I've been stumped, and I'm going to have to go and find that one out.
All right.
I don't know. I think that probably if they had found some lobsters given their state and somebody had showed them how they could be cooked, they probably were really at the point where they would have eaten anything. You know, survival sometimes trumps our religious thinking or our mores, and this was a matter of survival. So I can't say with certainty that they ate lobster, but I believe that they did, and I don't know how they got around the making it seem like it was, no pun intended, kosher. But it's a great question, and they were obviously people who were biblical literalists. They took the Bible seriously. That's one of the things that really separated Pilgrims and Puritans out from the Church of England and from Catholicism, that they believed the church was essentially a matter of you're going and reading the Bible, and they believed in the literacy of being able to read the Bible for yourself. And the King James Version, of course, was written in this period, translated, I should say, in this period for that reason, so that every Englishman could read the Bible for himself.
Did it take a long time for them, for the settlers then, after that first Thanksgiving, to get settled and well established?
Things picked up pretty quickly. First of all, they began to get more ships coming over. It wasn't like they were the only ones there for a very long time. Within a very short space of time, other groups came over, some of them not pilgrims and some of them not settling right nearby. Within the next year or two, there were a number of other settlements in this area of Massachusetts, including the very first settlement at Salem, which became a very, very important base for some of the English settlers. We associate Salem, of course, with the witch trials, but it was a very important town early on. But the Great Migration does not happen for 10 years. In around 1630, John Winthrop comes over with a fleet, bringing the first 1,500 Puritan settlers. And it was still difficult for them. And they, of course, found Boston when they get here. And Boston had been an old Puritan town in England, and that's why it was given the name that it was given.
So what happened in the years following the first Thanksgiving? You say there is a dark side to the story, that relationship with the indigenous populations did not continue.
No, it did not, and this is one of the reasons why there are still protests on Thanksgiving Day by descendants of the Wampanoag and other New England nations. The man who sat down to dinner with the pilgrims was named, we call him Massasoit, that may actually be his title rather than his name, mm-hmm. And he was the Sachem of the Wampanoag. His son went by the Indian name of, or the native name of, Metacom or Metacomet. He had adopted English dress. He wore armor, full armor, and so the English called him King Philip. He saw, as time went by, this wave after wave of English settler coming in. They were taking all the land. They were clearing the hunting lands and the forests for farms, and he saw the end of his way of life. He went to war with the English settlers in one of the bloodiest conflicts of colonial America called King Philip's War, and it was really a struggle to the death. It lasted for months. The English Americans at this point ultimately prevailed because of better weaponry, and they have made alliances with some of the other tribes who are traditional rivals of the Wampanoag. So there was a lot of fighting going back and forth, but this was a very, very brutal period in New England history, very far removed from our picture of the Indians and the pilgrims sitting down to that happy meal. And so the son of the chief who eats with the pilgrims is ultimately killed. His head is put on a spike or a pike in Boston as a warning to other rebels, and his child and wife are sold into slavery in the West Indies. And that is the dark sequel to the original Thanksgiving Day.
To what extent was slavery in part of warfare and just society at that point?
Well, for the Native Americans, it was completely part of their society, but in a very different way than we would understand slavery as it became practiced in America. You took slaves usually as war trophies, and very often they would almost become a member of the tribe as opposed to a slave who had to do all the dirty work for you. So it was a very different, and that of course is different in many different parts of North America. There are many references. This also falls into the hidden history of things, of many New England women, white New England women, were taken captive over many years. Some of them made their way back. Some of them did not. Some of them were quite content to remain with their Indian captors, and that's a story that the English didn't want to tell too much. It did not make good propaganda.
Right.
That the women folk were leaving and not coming back.
Fred in Columbus sent us an email, asks, I read that the Pilgrims learned about domesticating turkeys from the Indians. I find that hard to believe. What's true?
Domesticating turkeys. Now, that's another one where there might be a stumper.
Ooh.
There. We're going to have to...
Lobsters, turkeys.
We're going to have to work on that. I don't know about domesticating turkeys. We know that the turkey that they ate that day, that legendary, iconic day, was wild turkey, just as they had ducks and geese. Were they herding them and keeping them in pens? I mean, that's what an idea that certainly would have been not novel to the Pilgrims. So that one doesn't pass the sniff test for me.
Well, maybe if you do find anything out, you can post it to our Facebook page or something like that.
I will do that. On the domestication of the turkey, we'll call it.
Okay. And listeners out there, you can post your question or comments to our Facebook page as well. You can also call us at 614-292-8513. And you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, creating the Muppets movie comeback. We talk with Jason Segel and Nicholas Stoller, who co-wrote the new Muppets movie. Segel also stars in it. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or follow WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just visit WOSU.org/email to sign up. And join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow. Tomorrow morning in the first hour, women engineers in World War II and today. In the second hour of the program, lessons from Hollywood for better communication. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. 44 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clearing skies today. The clouds should be clearing up and a high of 50 degrees. Clear skies tonight as well, a low of 30. Expect some sunshine for Thanksgiving Day and a high of 56. More sunshine on Friday and a high of 61. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History. We're talking about Thanksgiving and early American history. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. 1-800-273-1313. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, too. The first successful English settlement in North America was Jamestown, Virginia, in 1607. Why do we celebrate the settlement of the New England colonists and not Jamestown? And I've Ken Davis?
Well, I guess the easy answer to that is that the people who wrote the first history textbooks were from Harvard, and they sort of had a tilt towards New England. I say that only half jokingly, because that's very true. Well, in the respect that we recognize the importance of Jamestown and the whole John Smith and Pocahontas, that's part of the certainly part of the American foundation legend as well. I think that because of this Thanksgiving holiday becoming so anchored in our roots and in our celebrations, it seems to take precedence over Virginia, even though obviously Virginia was there first, and Virginia would be a very, very important place in the early history of America, certainly producing four of our first five presidents, and so on. So I think it's really this mythic, iconic holiday that really sets the Pilgrim experience apart, and the creation of a holiday around it. I mean, we don't have a Jamestown holiday. It's as simple as that. You know, we don't have the ritual and reenactment of John Smith's head on the stone and Pocahontas saving him. But maybe that would make a good holiday. I don't know.
Are you, Ken, as you travel, what is your sense about how children are learning about Thanksgiving now? You've mentioned that, you know, back when you and I were kids, it was very different. We made little headdresses, and there were the Indians, and then we made, out of black construction paper, the funny little hats that the Pilgrims wore, and that was pretty much it.
Well, I think that, you know, that still goes on to a degree, especially in the earlier grades. You know, that would still be kindergarten through the first couple of years. But I find that talking to teachers and talking to kids about history, there's a much higher level of sophistication, and that's partly because history teachers have gotten a lot better, and our sense of history has gotten a lot better, and we know a lot more, and so we don't just accept the kind of old sanitized bedtime story version of history we had 50 years ago or 150 years ago. So I find the kids are much more sophisticated and usually tell their parents, no, you have it all wrong. And so that's always exciting, and it's always fun to see that exchange between parents and kids, where the kids become the teachers. And I do a lot of talking generally more to middle grade and high school groups about history, and I find that kids are really fascinated by this stuff. The notion that it's just old, boring old guys is not the impression I get from history teachers these days.
Is United States the only place that celebrates something like a Thanksgiving?
No, it's a very common idea around the world that because it's really a harvest feast that we're celebrating. And if you think, for instance, you know, in Judaism, there's a celebration of the harvest. In Canada, they celebrate it in October, which is much more appropriate.
Now, we mentioned earlier that Thanksgiving Day wasn't observed all over the U.S. until Abraham Lincoln declared it a national holiday in 1863. But you're saying that it was celebrated informally before that?
Well, more than informally, some state, going back to the day when, before there was a United States, there were New England colonies that had recognitions of this day as early as 1673. So it's an old idea to recognize this crucial piece of America's foundation story. But as a national holiday, it was really not until Lincoln, and it was certainly more typically celebrated in New England than in some of the other states. And of course, because Lincoln announced this holiday in the midst of the Civil War, as much as he hoped that it would unite the nation in a common bond, it was seen as a northern holiday for a very, very long time.
So back in the day of Lincoln, what was a national holiday? I mean, how big of a deal was a national holiday? Did workers get the day off kind of a thing? I mean,
well,
what did it mean back then?
It meant federal workers did. That would be the only thing. Mm-hmm. And because these were the days when the federal government couldn't really tell everybody what else to do, and there were certainly people would take their lead but a national holiday at that time really meant more of a making a proclamation, and certainly anybody who worked in the national government might have had the day off, but that didn't mean that the government could tell everybody what to do back then, and so it really became more of a tradition, and it's always been that way in terms of even the national holidays that we have today. When the government says it's a national holiday, they're basically saying it's the federal government and the national government is going to shut down, and everybody else beyond that is entitled to do what they like, whether it's at the state level or a business. That's why once upon a time, nothing was opened on Thanksgiving. Nothing was open on Christmas, but we know that has all changed.
Certainly has, hasn't it? We have just a few minutes left with my guest, Ken Davis. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History. We're talking about early American history and the traditions and history of Thanksgiving. If you have a question or comment, we welcome them. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from a listener says, yes, the pilgrims came here to get religious freedom, and some other original settlers in America did. Then later on, these same seekers of religious freedom denied it to some in their midst who didn't follow the main religious principles. Hence, Roger Williams fled to what is now Rhode Island. William Penn in what is now Pennsylvania organized his colony in a very religiously free manner. He, among a few others, was an exception to what I say above. Agree? Disagree, Ken?
I agree completely. He's singing my song in a way. yes, the pilgrims and the Puritans came for the freedom of religion, but their own, not anybody else's. It's rather stark to realize that the Puritans actually, when they were fully in charge of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and had the charter, they actually issued laws that banned the preaching of other religions, specifically Catholicism, Quakerism, and Baptists. In fact, four Quakers were actually executed in colonial Boston simply because they kept coming back to continue to preach their religion. So, you know, it's a very simple, facile thing to say they came for religious freedom, because that's not what they were about. The email mentions Roger Penn, Roger Williams. He's banished from Boston because his ideas don't fit in with the orthodoxy of the Puritans. He sets up his own colony in Rhode Island based on this remarkable notion that you pay the Indians for their land. That was pretty astonishing. He's joined a few years later by Anne Hutchinson, another dissident who had her own views of religion and was tossed out of the Bay Colony by John Winthrop and the Puritan fathers. Together with Roger Williams, Anne Hutchinson also helps write a constitution, a charter for Rhode Island that specifically mentions the freedom of religion or conscience, as they put it. That goes throughout all of early American history. We like to tout this so-called notion of a Christian nation. It was certainly a Protestant nation because Catholics were hated widely throughout the American colonies. There was tremendous hatred, bigotry, violence towards Catholics that carried over well into the 19th century. And one of the reasons that when John F. Kennedy was elected in 1960, it was a really big deal, because Catholic-Protestant relations in our country were really bad for a long, long time.
And the Protestants were the majority.
And the Protestants were the vast, vast majority until the great wave of migration in the 19th century, the potato famine migration and people leaving Germany and other countries. But still, Catholics were always a minority and a repressed minority in many places. There were rules against Catholics voting, rules against Catholics owning property in some states, as there were for Jews and so that's part of the big picture of religion in America that gets very, very much overlooked when we take this nice sanitized approach and says, oh, these people were all Christian who, you know, wanted Christian principles. It was a much more complex story.
Marge in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Marge.
Well, thank you so much. I am vigorously writing facts, I hear, from Mr. Davis to share with our grandchildren who are 5, 6, and 8, 10, and will be here tomorrow for Thanksgiving in our home. And I'll definitely upload Mr. Davis's book to my, I have an e-book, and I'm going to purchase it and send it along with the Christmas presents for our grandchildren in Georgia. They're 6, 9, and 11.
Oh, my work here is done.
They all got married in 2 years, too. Kindergarten, fourth, and middle school, sixth grade, and this is going to help them immensely. Thank you, Ann Fisher, for having a wonderful, informative, and enjoyable program. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Marge. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Take care.
Well, that made my Thanksgiving.
Me too.
But seriously, you know, it's a serious point because I started out 20 years ago writing for adults and don't know much about history, was written for adults. And then about 10 years ago, I added some children's books to the series because I did think that the only way we're going to get better at this is by having a conversation about it around the dinner table. Mm-hmm. So hearing the caller say that, it's my, you know, kind of my dream come true that the grandmas and the parents and the kids all sit down together and talk about history and, you know, shut the tube off for a while and talk about how interesting and fun this is because these are real people doing real things. It's not just dates and battles and speeches. And when we get away from that template for history and talk about the real people doing real things. It's alive, it's meaningful, it's fun, and it's most of all, it's human and it's important.
We have just a few minutes left, so don't wait until the last minute to talk with Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Don.
Good morning. I just had a question, at least one, about the Melungeons, if you could tell us much about the Melungeons that came into Virginia and ended up in eastern Kentucky and never were seen again.
You know what? And your audience is way, way too smart for me. I'm domesticating. This is a group I'm going to say I don't know much about. So
I'll give you an easy question then. How about an easy question?
Well, I've never heard of them either.
They were a group of Turkish people and Portuguese people that were on Portuguese boats that went to sail to America, and they ended up in Virginia, and they were abandoned. They were supposed to send a boat back out for them later, and they never did. So they went inland and married with the Indians and stuff.
When was this?
This is in the 1500s, very early on, and that's where the name Mullins comes from. If you ever know of anybody, Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well,
they're Melungeons.
Again, pricked my curiosity, and
yeah.
I always feel like I need to learn something.
Well, here's an easy question, though. How's this? if that one's too tough, who was the first president under the Articles of Confederation for America?
The first president of the United States, or just the first president? Because under the Articles of of Confederation, it would be John Hanson of Maryland. But Edmund Peyton actually was the first president of the Continental Congress, but there was no Articles of Confederation yet.
Okay, well, it's interesting to know there were lots of presidents and important people before Washington.
Yeah.
Well, there were 14 presidents of the United States, but it was presidents of the United States in Congress assembled, and they were it was really mostly presiding over Congress. You had no executive authority.
Thanks, Don, for that call. We have just a few minutes left, 614-292-8513. We have an email from George. He asks, do the myths of history include the Constitution's Establishment Clause? Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof by the states. The myth was that the original purpose of the clause was to prevent state religion. He says there's the reality is different, that the purpose was to deny the new federal government the power of religion and keep it exclusively for the state churches. Ken?
I'm going to disagree with that because when you read Madison, who wrote it, and most of the Constitution as well, and wrote the Remonstrance, which was against a bill in Virginia establishing a state religion, he makes it quite clear that there should be no state religion in any state, that this is what he called freedom of conscience. Washington writes about it. He says that this is not a right that a government can convey to anybody. This is the government doesn't tolerate religion. This is a natural right. So I think when you go back and look at the debates of in Congress over the First Amendment, you see that there was a lot of difference of opinion. There was even a movement in the Senate to make state that Christianity was the official religion of America, and that was rebuffed. These men knew that when a state becomes the head of, when you have the head of the government as the same as the head of the church, it's a dangerous combination. They fought a revolution to get away from that idea that the king was the head of the church as well as the head of the country, and they did not want that. They wanted a secular republic in which the government couldn't tell you you must pray, you can't pray, how to pray, or when to pray. So I'm gonna say no. I don't think that that is a myth at all. I believe that that's exactly what the framers of the Constitution and the authors of the First Amendment had in mind.
An email from Paul, he said, from the Discovery Channel's History of Beer. According to a historian on the program, European water was so bad that they made beer with it, and the pilgrims stocked beer to keep them hydrated and nourished. The narrator said that the pilgrims had planned to go to Virginia, but were running short on beer and had to land at Plymouth. He also mentioned that the pilgrims would not drink the pristine American water because they feared dying of disease. Any truth to that?
This is absolutely true. I'm going to defer on the one about whether they didn't get to Virginia because they were running short of beer. But beer was absolutely used widely and drunk widely, and it was because you didn't want to drink the water. You couldn't be sure that the water wasn't bad, but you knew the beer was good.
But would they avoid water in America because they weren't sure?
Yeah, in colonial America, it was practiced for a very long time. That water certainly was drawn from wells and used for many things. But when we just think of simple drinking water, and certainly at meals, beer was very, very widely served.
When we talked earlier,
which
on
makes prohibition and the whole Puritan thing about prohibition so interesting, because it was a very puritanical idea in the late 19th and early 20th century. But if you go back and look at the Puritans and the Pilgrims, they were very happily drinking beer.
You mentioned earlier that one of the big beneficiaries when Roosevelt tried to put Thanksgiving a week earlier than tradition was the, retailers. When did the shopping thing get so connected to Thanksgiving? We're a little out of time, but I thought we could wrap it up with that.
Well, the fact is that the retailers came to Roosevelt to ask him to do that, and he acceded to their wishes because they wanted to lengthen this. But as I mentioned, I think earlier, Macy's is already making that connection in 1921. So the idea that this was a prelude to going into the holiday season is a well-established one, certainly in the 20th century. Not too much reference to it in the 19th century, just because there wasn't really that much shopping yet. All comes a little bit later.
Well, I want to thank you, Ken Davis, for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, I'm always glad to do this, and I'm so thrilled that I have some new questions to answer about turkeys and people I had never heard of coming to America before. So next time I'm back, I'll have some answers for you.
Sounds great. Ken Davis.
Happy holiday.
Happy holiday to you as well, Ken. Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History, the anniversary edition, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. I want to thank our All-Side staff for getting us ready for this great holiday weekend. Producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurevich, All-Side's production assistant Jennifer Monroe, All-Side intern Corinne Gleckler, high school student intern Ben Faith, and our All Sides volunteers, very important, Ian Sheik, and also Rose Joe. Thank you, everybody, for helping us out. I hope everybody has a happy holiday. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7. This is WOSU Public Media.